All right, back to John chapter 18, where we're actually going to back up just some from where I read already to verse 12 so we can get a running start at where we're beginning this morning. In verse 12 of chapter 18, it tells us that a detachment of troops and the captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him, and then they led him away to Annas first because he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. And this was the Caiaphas who advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. And then skipping over Peter's denial there, which we dealt with last week, we start officially here in verse 19, where it says, the high priest then asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine. Well, you see now that Jesus is being interrogated and will be for the duration of our time together this morning and even into next week. For us anyway, but we have to understand that in the actual account, this was happening very quickly. Everything was moving along at a pretty good pace. The troops and the officers, the captains, led him away to Annas first, is what it tells us in verse 13. And then in verse 24 of our text this morning, it says, then Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, what John doesn't record in chapter 18 is that after they visited Caiaphas for a brief trial, they then went and brought Jesus before the official ruling committee called the Sanhedrin. You can find that in Luke chapter 22. So there was a total of three trials that were held before the highest religious authorities in that entire country, and they were looking for religious charges to bring against Jesus. Eventually, they would settle on the charge of blasphemy, and that, of course, would be a religious crime in the Jewish orthodoxy. So he begins with these three trials that are religious in nature, but that's not the end of it. Jesus will go on to have three more trials in front of the Roman authorities by the time he's crucified in short order. And those trials would be civil in nature. So he's got three religious trials to endure, three civil trials that concern the charge of insurrection. Of course, Roman authorities don't care who blasphemes who. It's not really an issue for them. But insurrection is. Treason is. At any rate, Jesus will have six trials to go through, all of them very brief. And for the record, all six of them happening between 2 in the morning and 7:30 in the morning. Six trials in less than 6 hours. And in the wee hours of the morning, nonetheless. And it's interesting to me because if you read any of the Gospels, none of them indicate that any of those who were involved in these hearings needed to be woken up. None of them needed to get dressed. None of them needed to don the official priestly garb. It seems that they were all ready and waiting. 2 in the morning? I'm sorry, if you drop by my house at 2 in the morning, I am probably asleep. If I'm waiting for you to get there and I'm all dressed and ready, that means that this was arranged. I was expecting you. They were expecting this to happen. You have to understand that Jesus' trials were plotted. His betrayal was plotted. His arrest was plotted. These interrogations, all of it is planned out, and now it's just happening according to plan. Judas was in on it. The Pharisees were in on it. The Roman government was in on it. And let's not forget that God was in on it. God had planned this before Pilate, before Judas, before any of the high priests, Caiaphas, Annas, any of them were even born. It was God's eternal will by his own decree that his only begotten son should come into the world and die for the sins of man, being betrayed into Gentile hands and crucified to raise again the third day. So this is all happening according to plan. But from a human perspective, we can learn something from it. Nobody ever, ever accidentally rejects Jesus like this. It's always strategic. That's good news for some of us who are like, whoa, I just had a bad thought. Am I out of the club? Probably not. Probably not. Jesus is really gracious. He's really merciful. Okay, so you're not going to just accidentally go to hell? You're not going to accidentally find yourself on Jesus's bad side? This was planned. And by the way, a lot of what they're doing here is illegal, these chief priests who should know better, these high officials, these lawyers, these scribes, these Pharisees, the Sanhedrin, all of them understand the rules. These were the highest of authorities. They needed to understand the rules and be familiar with what was on the law books. So they knew that they were breaking these rules. I'll give you a few of them. By law, their own law, proceedings like these were never to be held at night. Well, 2 a.m. constitutes night in my book, right? 3 o'clock in the morning, listen, it's dark out, we should be sleeping, right? The first two trials were held at night, 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the morning, respectively. Secondly, Jewish courts required 2 full days and 2 nights to pass after hearing testimony in a capital crime trial. They required the passing of time, 2 days and 2 nights, whereby the judges would eat only light food and drink only light wine, being sure to get good sleep before reconvening after 2 days to hear the same testimony again and vote with a clear mind. Because this was serious business. Somebody might die. You want to be thinking clearly. You want to make sure that you're well rested. You want to make sure that you hear the evidence perhaps twice instead of once. But these men, they reached a verdict within 6 hours' time. They didn't need a whole lot of deliberation. They didn't get good sleep. No way. Nor were they thinking clearly. Nor is anybody who would reject Jesus like these have. That isn't a clear-thinking individual to hastily erase Jesus from your life. Then, if this wasn't enough, when it was time to render a verdict, Jewish law required that the voting of the officials was to be sequential, one at a time, and from oldest to youngest. And the reason why is they didn't want the older ones to vote first and influence the vote of the younger, more experienced members of the Sanhedrin. But if you read through the Gospels, it doesn't seem like they voted one after another. It seems very clearly as if they reached their verdict simultaneously. Furthermore, their law required that the accused be represented by an attorney. Jesus was never given an attorney. The law also required proof of guilt. They had no such proof against Jesus. So here they are, breaking all kinds of rules to get Jesus out of their life. I mean, this is atrocious that this is even happening. But the same is true even today when people do a similar thing. They're largely unaware of how much guilt they incur for themselves when they reject Jesus. I don't think we know what we're doing when we want something in life so badly that we have to defy Christ to get it. I don't think we're aware of how much guilt we accrue in doing so. It's impossible to not stack charges against yourself at the same time as you reject the authority of Jesus. Now, among all these other legal requirements was the obligation of the prosecution to secure testimony from no less than 2 credible witnesses, and that's their first order of business, is we need somebody to stand up and give testimony against something that Jesus did wrong. And if you read the Gospels, they'll take anybody. They can't find any credible witnesses, so they're even looking for false witnesses, and they can't produce anything until it says in an adjacent gospel that finally a couple of squirrely fellas stepped forward and said, well, we heard him say that he would destroy the temple and build it again in 3 days, so that's got to be something. And, you know, of course, well, then that's enough. We got it now. But at this point in the judicial hearing, they're looking for witnesses. And so in verse 19 is where we start this morning. The high priest is interrogating Jesus about his disciples, his followers, his students, and his doctrine, what he's teaching them. So Jesus says, I spoke openly to the world. I always taught in the synagogues. I always taught in the temple. I always taught publicly. I taught right in front of everybody. We're the Jewish people. They always meet there. I've said nothing in secret. So he says, why are you asking me? Ask them. In other words, produce a witness. If I'm such a criminal, you should have plenty of fodder against me. Tons of evidence, Jesus said. I've been teaching for 3.5 years. You want to quiz me on my doctrine? 3.5 years I've been teaching in synagogues all the time. Everybody knows my doctrine. Go ask anybody. They're looking for a witness against Jesus. But of course, they're not able to produce one. And there's reasons for that. One is because it's 2 a.m. You know, anybody with any sense is sleeping at that hour. So there aren't a whole lot of people available. But that's not the only reason. The other reason, and the real reason here, why they weren't able to produce a credible witness against Jesus is because there never was, nor will there ever be, a credible witness against Jesus. You cannot be against him and win. He does nothing wrong, right? We need to remind ourselves this morning, Jesus is perfect. He's perfect. Never done anything of which to be accused of. But he reminds them anyway. He reminds them of their own law. Hey, you got to produce a witness. And there's lots of them out there if I'm indeed a criminal, so go get one. And he's reminding them that they're required to produce a witness, not because he thinks that it's possible to find one at that hour or in the world at all, but because Jesus is the kind of guy who refuses to let a person's conscience ignore what they're doing. He's compounding their guilt. Go find one. It's on you. They don't like that. That's why they hit him. That's why the very next verse says that they hit him. What else were they supposed to do? I mean, you can't get Jesus out of your life without some sort of physical, or in our case, spiritual abuse. Twisting of the facts, forcing him to lose. I mean, these guys can't even meet the requirements of their own law. But they don't want to admit that they're wrong either, so they punch him in the face. Now, the Jewish priesthood, you know, the high priest, you can trace that high priest way back, all the way back to Aaron. But that priestly order, that lineage, is going to end only a few decades after Jesus is crucified. When the temple is destroyed, which it was destroyed after his death and resurrection in 70 AD, the Jewish priesthood ended. So since then, there's never been another Jewish high priest. So we've been living in a world that has none for the last 2,000 years. And yet, believe it or not, the same spirit, the same high priestly spirit is alive and well in 2019. There may not be an actual man by name who serves that office, but there is a spirit that you would find all over the world and in churches across our own country, even this morning, that essentially is identical. People who appear at least give the appearance of being a religious chief, so to speak, a professional, an expert, when really they're more religiously devout in public than in private. They put on a good show in front of others, but behind closed doors, they're abusive toward Christ, knowing quite well that what they're doing hurts him, but doing it anyway. These would be Christians, so to speak, who hate it when Jesus interferes with their life. It just bugs them. And then eventually, they start making secret moves to get rid of him altogether so that they can finally enjoy their Christianity without him, which is ironic that they would carry on with the religious routine even though they've fully rejected Christ, but many do it. Again, it's the spirit of the high priest. Well, they're going nowhere and getting nowhere with Jesus, and so that's why verse 24 tells us that they had to adjourn only long enough to take him to another court, and this would be in front of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. The first one was Annas. That was Caiaphas's father-in-law, who had also served as high priest but had been in retirement for about 15 years now. His son-in-law Caiaphas had now assumed that position. So both Annas and Caiaphas were very prominent and powerful heads of Israeli orthodoxy, and so they're bringing him now to Caiaphas. It would be there in front of the real high priest that Caiaphas would put Jesus under oath and demand to know if he was the Son of God. And Jesus affirms that, and then he's immediately charged with the blasphemy that gave them justification to have him moved along to be tried and found guilty of that religious charge. Okay? So it is now at this point in the narrative that Jesus is found guilty of a Jewish crime worthy of death, but they're not allowed to put people to death because they're occupied by Rome and under Roman authority, and so they now need to move him along to the Roman authorities and have him found and tried according to some criminal charge that would be worthy of death in the Roman world. So they're only halfway there, but they do have enough momentum to keep the thing going. I said it before, but blasphemy means nothing to a Roman court, and so they need to find additional charges if they hope to have him executed. The Romans wouldn't allow Jews to carry out executions, so they're off now to see the governor. And that's where we find ourselves in verse 28, where it says then that they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the praetorium, and it was early morning now. But they themselves wouldn't go into the praetorium. Apparently the praetorium is Gentile territory, that's Roman territory. And it's interesting here, they wouldn't even set foot over the threshold lest they should be defiled. They didn't want to dishonor God. You just punched his only begotten kid in the head. And now you're concerned about leaving footprints on Gentile soil? I mean, you know, the ridiculous nature of the whole thing is almost laughable if it wasn't so serious. The real reason that they didn't want to defile had really nothing to do with whether they were honoring God or not. We know that they had no desire to honor God. The real reason was because they wanted to eat their holiday meal. They wanted to eat Passover. Fact is, Passover meal was done. There was a secondary feast that would have been enjoyed during that multi-day festival. This was like dessert. You know, I'm going to abuse God with the way I live my life, but then I'm going to be careful to not disqualify myself from pumpkin pie. Okay, it becomes very clear in verse 28 what's important to these guys. The Apostle Paul kind of encapsulates that idea when he says, there's a whole lot of Christians today whose God is their belly. Whose God is their belly. They don't worship the Lord, they worship carnal appetites. And here we see it illustrated for us in the mannerisms of the Jewish elite. They didn't want to go in there because they were on the verge of defiling themselves if they were to step across that boundary. Some people might be fooled into believing that as long as they strictly adhere to scriptural commands and religious regulations that says then they're in love with God. When we see here that you can be quite strict in your religious practice and still have an extremely cold heart. I would go so far as to say, and some people would disagree with me, but I think it's true that you don't need any love at all to practice formal Christianity. I hate to say it, but I think there are a lot of people in the church that prove that. Jesus himself hit the nail on the head. He goes, in the latter days, which we're living in now, he says, the love of many, many are going to grow cold. They'll do Christianity. They'll have a form of godliness, but they'll deny his power. They will have grown oh so cold that they will essentially, again, do what the high priests of old have done. It's the same spirit. Honoring God by being careful where you step, but then being abusive toward the one that God loves. You might be surprised to know that there are, again, some of those in Christianity that perhaps you consider to be some of the finest examples of Christian devotion. You think that they're the shining example of a godly marriage, or that he is a good example of spiritual masculinity, or that she in the church is a good example of spiritual femininity. You might be surprised this morning to find that some of those might actually be the worst examples to follow. And that may be the only reason you see them that way is because they want you to see them that way, and they work so hard to make sure that you do see them that way. These guys look awesome from verse 28. Boy, they are so committed to God, they won't even step over the threshold, but they demand the governor, the guy in charge, to come out to them. Man, they must really love the Lord. I want to follow that example. Listen, if you follow that example, you'll be punching Jesus in the face. That's not a good example to follow. Don't follow the example of a marriage that seems great. Don't be quick to follow the example of a man or a woman who seems to be ultra devoted to Jesus. Oftentimes it's a show, just like theirs was. Some people who seem to be the most careful to respect the spiritual boundaries of their religion are actually the first ones to cross them when no one's watching. So be careful of whose example you follow. Verse 29, Pilate then goes out to them, says, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" And they answered and said to him, "Trust us." That's the paraphrase there. Trust us. Right? Hey, if he wasn't an evildoer, he hadn't done something wrong, we wouldn't have delivered him up to you. So just, we don't need to explain everything. Just take our word. No. They're wanting him to be crucified. They've already found Jesus guilty of blasphemy. You got to wonder, why not just kill him right there? Why wait for Rome's permission? Well, they insist in verse 31 here that, well, it's not legal for us to put anyone to death. That's true. However, it's not going to stop them from executing Stephen in Acts chapter 7. They stoned him to death without Roman permission. It's not like they're always walking carefully according to Roman law. They do what they want, these Jewish folks. So why are they all of a sudden now with Jesus being ultra careful? I'll give you two reasons. And the real reason is given in verse 32, so that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spoke, signifying by what death he would die. Jesus had already prophesied that he would be crucified, not stoned to death, which was the formal method of execution practiced by the Jews from long ago. So the real reason these Jews are passing Jesus along to the Roman authorities is because it has to be done in order for prophecy to be fulfilled. Not that the Jews are interested in fulfilling prophecy, but they're on a rail that God has developed for them, and they can't get off of it. They're going to do God's will, whether they're on the good side of that or the bad side of that. And there was a lot of prophecies offered, both Old Testament and New, of Jesus being crucified. Jesus dying in the way that he did fulfilled prophecies from Isaiah in chapter 53 and probably elsewhere. Isaiah said that we were healed by Jesus' stripes. The stripes that he's speaking of are the whip marks that he would receive across his back. That doesn't happen when you're stoned to death. That happens when you're whipped and scourged and crucified. David prophesied of the Messiah being crucified when he said in Psalm 22, "They have pierced my hands and feet." Zechariah, an Old Testament prophet, foretold of the manner in which the Messiah would die when he said in chapter 12 of his book, quote, "They will look on me whom they have pierced," end quote. Pierced. Nails stuck through the man. That doesn't happen when you're stoned to death. Not to mention the prophecies of Jesus himself in the New Testament when he told us that he would be lifted up. The Son of Man must be lifted up, signifying by what death he would die. He had told his disciples very clearly that he was to be, quote, "delivered to the Gentiles, to be mocked and scourged and crucified," end quote. So prophecies of Christ were crucifixion specific. So that's why the Jews inexplicably are collaborating with Rome and, you know, submitting to their authority here when elsewhere they don't. But there's another reason. There's another reason why they're doing this. And that's because the Jews needed someone to share the responsibility with of putting Jesus to death. They needed to share this with somebody. It is not a comfortable mission to try and accomplish by yourself. Defying Christ is taxing on the conscience. And history shows, the Bible shows, and my experience shows that rarely is someone willing to do that by themselves. More times than not, when somebody wants to erase Jesus from their life, they already anticipate the guilt that they're going to feel for it, and so they enlist the help of anyone who might be willing to share in that responsibility. Sometimes they get so desperate that, like these Jews, they're even willing to subject themselves to the most awkward of partnerships. They force themselves out of necessity to work with people they would normally avoid. But hey, we suddenly have something in common, so can we work together, Romans? Jews hated Romans. Romans hated Jews. But we share mutual hatred, so maybe we can work with each other here, huh? Nudge, nudge. Wink, wink. So in verse 33, Pilate then entered the praetorium, and he called Jesus to himself. This is Pontius Pilate, if you're not aware of his full name, Pontius. I'm not aware of a lot of people that name their boys Pontius, just like I'm not aware of many Judases. You know, there's a few names that kind of go down in infamy in a bad way, and this is, of course, one of them. But Pontius Pilate served as Roman governor of that area on the map, and he was an interesting fellow. If you read the Gospels, and that's all that you know of this man, you may get the impression that he was kind of a pushover, passive. He was rather vacillating and all the rest. That is not the case. There's a reason he appears that way in the Gospels, and it's because of the situation he had gotten himself into with the Roman government for actually being the opposite of that. He was a very aggressive man. You didn't want to cross him. He used his power and his authority to the nth degree. And reports had gotten back to Roman headquarters, and Pilate was at this time under surveillance. There was a letter written during that time by Agrippa to Caligula, two names that both of them, I believe, come up in the book of Acts. Agrippa wrote to Caligula, and in that letter he says, quote, about Pilate, he is unbending and recklessly hard. He is a man of notorious reputation, severe brutality, prejudice, savage violence, and murder, end quote. That's the Pontius Pilate of the Bible. Apparently the man loved his job, and he took full advantage of it as being a venue through which he could exercise his ungodly desires. He loved to be in charge. Loved it. He was a man who needed authority, and being governor gave him that authority. So he didn't want to lose his job. So he was fairly protective of his job. He didn't want to lose it. But because of his demeanor, Pilate was now under investigation by Rome for the reports that had made their way all the way back to the emperor, which put him in jeopardy of losing the job that he loved so much. His job was his life. For him, that was the only thing worth living for. Keep that in mind as we proceed. Because the things that Jesus is going to say to him is going to threaten him with job loss. And yet, the things that the Jewish populace is going to scream in reply are going to put him equally at risk of losing his job. Pilate has been placed by God in a very precarious position. He's being forced to act upon what he knows is true and right about Christ, or compromise altogether, have Christ crucified so that he can keep what he's gained in life. He asks Jesus, "Are you the king?" In verse 33, "Are you the king?" The king. That's what concerned Pilate. King. Whether this was a king. He didn't care that Jesus claimed to be Son of God. He didn't care whether or not people hailed this man as the Messiah. That was all religious in nature. But king had something personal to do with Pilate, who actually is a lot like some of us. We got no problem with Jesus being the Son of God. We have no problem with Jesus being Messiah. What we have a problem with is Jesus being king, being Lord. Because that's the part that touches our life in the practical realm, like it did for Pilate. You can be Messiah all you want. I have no problem with that. I'll let you save me. That's great. You're Messiah. You're the Savior. But Lord? I mean, that's really the hang-up for a lot of people today, guys. Yes, you want Jesus to save you. I don't know. I've yet to meet somebody who's like, I want to go to hell. Nobody does. So save me. Thank you. But then leave me alone after that. Save me from whatever it is that puts my eternal soul in jeopardy. But then leave me alone about how I handle my finances or who I engage with in a certain area of intimacy. Please leave me alone about what I do on the weekends. Leave me alone about what I drink or eat. Leave me alone about how I dress or who I spend time with. Leave me alone. Just leave me alone. I'll catch up with you when I die, Jesus. And till then, leave me alone. And so it's the king issue that really bothers Pilate. So are you the king? Are you in full authority? Do you have that right? Are you in a position to affect my life personally? Do you have a say over how I live in the practical realm? And Jesus says in verse 34, are you asking me or is that just what you heard? This is brilliant. Brilliant. Are you speaking for yourself, he says. I think there's a lot of people in here who would call Jesus Lord. But the question applies. You call him Lord just because that's what you heard from others? Or is he actually your Lord? Do you say this yourself? Or did others just tell you that about Jesus? I think we know full well that accepting Jesus as Lord is going to affect our life just about as much as accepting Christ as King would affect Pontius Pilate's life. It's just too much for some people. That's the sad truth. And so what can we expect of somebody who's been confronted by God to either allow Jesus access to their life as Lord, full control, or to reject it when the opportunity comes? Well, here's what happens. In verse 35, Pilate gets what seems to be a little bit hot. Am I a Jew? Your own nation. The chief priest delivered you to me. What'd you do? What have you done? Now, did you know that nobody in the whole New Testament, from what I understand, asked Jesus more questions than Pontius Pilate did? And if you let your eyes go all the way down to verse 38, there may be none of all the questions that he ever asked Jesus that was more significant than the one he asks at the beginning of that verse. What is truth? What is truth? And as significant as that question was, nobody seems to know how that question was asked. I'm reading commentaries and nobody knows, because you can't read tone into the Bible always. So it's like an email, right? You get it and you're like, what does that mean? Like, you can read what it says, but you're like, how did they, what? There's something I don't. And that's exactly what's going on here. So commentary is all over the place on this one. One commentary says, quote, it's difficult to say what he meant. Was he puzzled or sarcastic or interested? End quote. Another commentary says, quote, we find ourselves at a loss to interpret why he asked this. Was he being facetious or scornful? Impatient or cynical? Despairing or sincere? Hard to tell. We're left to wonder, end quote. And I'm reading on and on. Some think that he was jesting. Some think that it all over the place. Here's what I find. Listen, while commentary tends to focus on the question that was being asked, let's this morning pay close attention to the answer that was given. There was none. That's easier to read into than the tone of the question itself. Jesus didn't answer him. Two reasons for that. Jesus refused to answer him. That's reason number one. Second reason is Pilate didn't wait for an answer because he didn't want one. Pilate already knew what the truth was. Read the second half of verse 38. He says, what is truth? And then he steps back out there and says, I find no fault in him at all. That's the truth. You already know the truth. It's not Jesus' fault. He's not guilty. He didn't do anything wrong. He's perfect. He's holy. He's the Son of God like he said. There's never been another man like him because he's hardly a man. He's God. Pilate already knew that. He just didn't want it to be clarified. He didn't want the truth to be clarified. He wanted the truth to go away. He wanted the truth to leave him alone. Guys, everybody knows the truth. Romans chapter 1 explains how it's impossible to miss the truth of God. Romans chapter 1 explains how there is such overwhelming evidence about God's existence that there will be nobody without excuse. Not the Aborigine, not the guy who was somehow born and lived and died all by himself on that stranded island. Nobody. God is a righteous judge, and he has made himself known to the human race. And we know the truth. We know the truth. We may pretend to not. I'll give you that. That happens all the time. Pilate is pretending to have less of the truth than he really does. He knows the truth. He says it himself. There is no fault in this man. In verse 39, we move on to a man named Barabbas. But before we do, I want you to consider something about Pontius Pilate, because I don't want him to come and go without a little bit of further consideration. Reason being, the modern church is as full of high priests today as it is of Pontius Pilates. They fit the profile exactly. Who are they? They are those who serve as the reigning governor of their own private kingdom. They're in charge of their life, and they absolutely cherish the power. They've spent many long years of their life aware of Jesus, but indifferent to him, just like Pilate was, until suddenly God put them in a situation where they had to act upon what they knew was true, or have Christ crucified all over again. And many today go down the same road as Pilate did. And in the end, they lose control over the very life that they defied Jesus to keep. The human conscience, ladies and gentlemen, wasn't designed to handle it when its owner defies Christ. History tells us that Pilate was eventually banished by Caligula to Gaul, a distant region, far to the northwest of Italy, beyond the Alps. He lost the job he defied Christ to keep. There, he suffered what sounds like an emotional or mental breakdown, and ultimately committed suicide. Pontius Pilate wouldn't be the last man to lose his mind pretending to not know the truth. Lost his mind. Killed himself. And we know why. See, a lot of people today would classify that as mental illness. It's not. The Bible shows us that the real issue was truth rejection. Makes me wonder how much, quote, mental illness today is actually truth rejection. Jesus said, you keep your life, you live it how you want, you want to be your own governor, I'll let you. But even what you have will be lost. Those who keep their lives will lose them. Now we have Barabbas entering stage left. Pilate says, you have a custom that I should release someone to you at the Passover. Do you therefore want me to release to you, King of the Jews? He's trying to get himself off the hook, but it's not that easy. They all cried again, saying, no, not this man, Barabbas. Barabbas had already been tried and convicted legally. They did it right for him. No doubt he had a defense attorney appointed to him. No doubt there were credible witnesses that gave testimony. There was no doubt this being a capital offense, 2 days and two nights of intermission, all the legal elements that were missing in Jesus' six trials were present for the one that Barabbas went through, and he was proven guilty, whereas Jesus had nothing on himself. The very last line of our text this morning says that Barabbas was a robber. In the original language, the word robber indicates that he would take by violence. He would take by violence. The name Bar Abba. You know what Abba means? It means father. Putting the prefix bar in front of it just simply means son, son of the father. Son of the father. In Matthew's gospel, you might have to look at the original text, but I don't know if you guys know this. Barabbas' real full name was Jesus Baraba. Jesus, son of the Father. Learned to take by violence. Suddenly confronted by Jesus, son of the Father, who gives out of love. Though they share the same name, they couldn't be more opposite individuals. The Son of God, Jesus Christ, knew no sin, but the Bible says that he became sin so that we, like Baraba, might be acquitted of the charges against us. The charges that have already been proven, like we've produced enough evidence for sure. So that we could be legally and permanently exonerated, that the guilt against us would be removed, and then we become true sons of God ourselves, daughters of God through faith in Christ. I think the church has many high priests in it, so to speak. I think the church in 2019 has many Pontius Pilate governors in it, but I also think it's true that the church is full of modern Barabbas. And you might be one of them. And I hope you are. What do I mean by that? I mean you're hardly any different than him. You've left a long, long trail of condemning evidence that proves that you've committed the very sins Jesus never did and died for anyway. I hope you're honest as you look back over the course of your life and realize that to be true. You've lived your life as a taker, regardless of the effect that it had on others. And now, because Jesus, the Son of God, was a giver, you've become a child of God yourself. You got to wonder what it was like for Barabbas on that day. He's off stage, able to hear what's going on. He knows there's a commotion in the courtyard. He hears the masses gathering. He hears the shouts of the crowd. Crucify him! He must have thought that it was him they spoke of. And when the guard came down the hall, rattling his keys, opened up the door, he must have thought, this is it for me. This is the end of the road. I'm going to die. And they march him out to the court steps, and there's this other man who he knows nothing of. And he begins to quickly survey the scene and realizes that they're chanting for the blood of this mysterious stranger. And suddenly the entire city is on his side saying, "Free Barabbas." And the cuffs are undone, and the door is open for him to go. The Bible doesn't tell us, nor does history, as far as I can find, what came of him. I hope he took that to heart, because I want to meet him. There's all kinds of people I want to meet in heaven. David's one of them, and Moses is one of them, and I'd like to have lunch with Elijah. But you know what? Who would be a really fun individual to talk with? Barabbas. You sit down across a table in the heavenly realm for pizza, because there will be pizza there. And you look at him and you go, "What was that like? Knowing that you deserved death. And like it was down to the wire. And then in the nick of time, Jesus came along and saved you. What was that like?" And he looks at you and goes, "You tell me. No different. We were both on death row, dude. Or dudette." No different. I think the church has many in it this morning who are functional modern day Barabbas. The guards have come to let you go. They aren't screaming for your blood. They got what they wanted. You're set free. Some of us, we don't need to wonder what it was like for Barabbas because we already know. Are you one of them? Does your life show it? Are you a son of God? A daughter of the Father? It was that cross in the middle that Jesus died upon. It wasn't meant to be his. Barabbas was supposed to be up there that day, but he wasn't. Jesus was instead. I wonder if that man hightailed it out of town, never to look back. I mean, he just went and hid in the cliffs. Or if he hung around for the next few hours to watch another man carry his cross for him. And I wonder what that did to his heart. What does it do to yours if you let your mind's eye imagine Jesus carrying a cross that had your name on it? It was hewn out of rough wood to grace your back. What does that do to your heart? Father, we look to Christ this morning as one who has taken our place, knowing that if the scene was before us in real time, there would be a whole hill full of crosses, not just three, but millions upon millions upon millions of them, one of them in the fray having our name on it. But what you did, Christ, on that day from the center cross was enough to pay the price for all of those crosses. Each one of us meant to die, but spared in the nick of time. I pray that we would just allow ourselves to consider whether we're functioning this morning as a proverbial high priest, where we, like they, are bossing Jesus around, abusing him in secret places, putting on a good public show as if we were almost holy when indeed we're not. Or if perhaps we are of the same spirit as the governor Pontius Pilate. Cherishing the power that we've been given of our own free will, exercising it to a sinful degree, and incurring for ourselves great guilt. Defying you along the way, slowly losing our minds and our lives and everything that we've worked so hard to acquire or keep. Or if indeed we are Barabbas. We pray this morning, Lord, that if we haven't yet understood what you've done in our place, that you would melt our hearts with understanding. Let's all stand.